Eager on the Free Press Media Show, talking today about some misconceptions of Islam and Muslim people. We're also going to be talking about what's happening in Iraq and some other important political issues. This is Amiga on the Free Press Media Show on NIM FM 102.3. First of all, I'd like to talk about Islamic beliefs. All Muslims believe in one God, Allah, Allah meaning the God in Arabic. The Prophet Muhammad as the messenger of God, accountability of life on this earth and eternal life after death, the essential equality, believe it or not, of all human beings, yes, even us, the non-believers. The Quran, the literal and unadulterated word of God as spoken to Muhammad, and the source book of Islam beliefs, principles and values. The Hadith, the collected sayings and actions of the Prophet Muhammad, second source of the Quran. So that is their beliefs. Yeah, there's nothing in there about suicide bombers. And in fact, I got from a very good Muslim source that if you are a suicide bomber and you do go in and kill a number of innocent people, then according to Allah and Muhammad, you shall relive that experience for eternity again and again. There's no reward in heaven. And some five pillars of Islam. Creed, a declaration that there is no deity but the one and only God, and Muhammad is the messenger of God. 2. Prayers, salat, short prayers performed 5 times daily. 3. Fasting, sayum, a month-long abstinence from food, liquids and intimate intercourse between married couples every day from dawn to sunset during Ramadan, the 9th month of the Muslim calendar. 4. Purifying alms, zakat, an obligation to make charitable donations. That's actually written into their law. And 5. Pilgrimage, haji, journey to Mecca in Saudi Arabia, which should be made at least once in a lifetime. Wow, what a wonderful way to live life, that you're meant to give charitable alms and that you should go to a really amazing place once in your life. Customs and terms explained of Islam. Islam asks men and women to cover certain parts of their bodies in order to detach themselves from physical identification so that they can develop spiritually. Women are required to cover the whole body, including excluding face, hands and feet. This is in public. Men are required to cover up from the top of the belly to below the knees. That's above the belly to below the knees. Covering the face is not a general requirement of Islam. So, you know, you don't have to. Now, jihad, literally meaning to struggle or strive in Arabic. Jihad is the struggle against adversity. General jihad is the personal pursuit of intellectual and spiritual enlightenment and the fight against wrong belief, physical desires and evil inclinations. Lesser jihad involves encouraging others to follow this path. In this context, some Muslims support political struggle against secular regimes seen to be oppressive and anti-Islamic. The Prophet Muhammad decreed that military jihad may be a last resort and only in self-defense. So they are not entitled, according to their religion, to start wars, but they're allowed to defend themselves. George Bush seems to have unbridled legitimacy in starting wars, which doesn't seem, unfortunately, to be written into his creed. So now we are having some music from a beautiful local band who are reggae and are doing great things down at the Bush Factory, including tonight, and they have a song about jihad, and this is what their lead singer has to say.
This next song is called Jihad, and what it explains is that what the mass media would like you to think the word jihad is a war that people are inflicting on other people. But the truth is that jihad is something that the Muslims believe is a struggle from within, you know, it's between right and wrong, you know, and they'd like us to make us think we're all different and don't feel the same things. But I think we're all going through a bit of a struggle nowadays, you know? And this song just explains that a little bit. it's quite long good. But we've heard it before. Yeah, they tried to take the world by force. They say it's for our own good, but it's all a devil's ploy. And if the jihad, they like it or not, holy struggle's what they got. And a jihad, whether they like it or not, holy struggle, not a holy war. It's a fight from within.
That is One for One, who you can catch tonight down at the Bush Theatre for the reggae night down there. And I urge everyone to get down to the Bush Theatre. I've been there a couple of times. The restaurant is fantastic. And they've got a reggae night tonight and more live stuff tomorrow night. A revitalization of our culture. And I like to talk about a bit more about culture, particularly some misconceptions concerning women and Islam. We must disentangle culture and religion when discussing the treatment of women. Let's have a look. The Prime Minister John Howard has expressed concern about Muslim attitudes to women. He should talk. While the New South Wales Police Minister Carl Scully has said that some men of Middle Eastern background hold quite disgusting views towards women. Oh yeah, what about Tony Abbott? I'll talk about him in a minute. All of this helps fuel the argument that Islam treats women as second-class citizens. It is not necessarily so now, any more than 1400 years ago, when Islam gave women rights that were unprecedented throughout the world. Muslim women had spiritual equality, the right to an independent legal personality, the right to own property, the right to choose their own husband, and the right to seek a divorce. In a speech that considered the historical position of women, a Sydney Muslim scholar, Dr. Ibrahim Abu Muhammad, said that the Prophet Muhammad's message elevated women in a position where she was granted her natural rights as a human being. Something that's not happening worldwide in a lot of cultures, unfortunately, now, especially when it comes to bombs. This message came to societies, he said, that had previously taken pride in the birth of males and felt ashamed when a female was born. Islam has changed this. Islam teaches that mothers must be honored and treated with kindness and respect. He continued that Allah, or God, will regard with favor the men who treat their wives gently and well, and that raising a daughter is one means of earning the grace of Allah and entry to heaven. So who is to blame for the misconceptions about women in Islam today and for the unsatisfactory reality? To say it is the fault of men or the media is tempting, but simplistic. Islam is not the problem. People have made it the problem. As a religion, Islam promotes education and has never denied women the right to learn. In fact, the first word revealed in the Quran is Iqra, or read. This message is for all Muslims, regardless of gender or age. But cultural practices are often confused or mistaken for religious teachings. While there is no denying that the two are intertwined, it is only through better education that the distinction between them can be better understood. Many of the problems facing women in the Muslim community, such as a man's role in the home, are the same as those in other communities. And I'd like to talk a bit more about that. That, by the way, was from an article by Nadia Jamal, which was in the Herald the other week. But I'd like to say women still can't be ordained as Catholic priests. Most politicians are men, especially leaders. Just look at what happened to Pauline Hanson, crucified by that Tony Abbott's Kill Hanson Slush Fund. And hasn't Howard rewarded Mr. Abbott with nice portfolios like the health minister? And look at his moral stance on women. Mr. Abbott, abortion, which he has been rightly castigated, with over 250 women reportedly raped every day in Australia, childcare at an all-time low, especially Indigenous women, and the poverty of the poverty of single parents and women, especially Indigenous women, have little rights in this country. So I'd like to ask Mr. John Howard and all those other detractors out there, Mr. Downer, and particularly Mr. Abbott, when you give us Australian women equal rights, then start pointing the finger overseas, because we know that this dissing of Muslim and Islam is all to do with oil and the greedy takeover of the Middle East because of the worldwide oil shortage, definitely brought on by many things, one of which I will be discussing. The leader of the insurgency himself in Iraq, Abu Musa al-Zarqawi, I'm not very good at some of these names, forgive me, who has vowed to continue to use guns and suicide bombers in an attempt to ebb the dwindling Sunni power base, has said, "The enemies of God are aware that this war is a turning point in the world, and it's a crossroad between the absolute control of the apostate West and between the upcoming Islam nation." Zarqawi wrote under the name of Al-Qaeda in the Land of the Two Rivers. "Islam nation recognizes jihad in Iraq before the majority of the apostates stand against the Mujahideen. If jihad is weakened and its pockets are closed, the nation will be smothered, the nation will be humiliated, and punishments will be imposed on it. And you, Arab rulers, are you who have accepted to be shoes for the sinful and are launching for the plains of killing and destruction, and you are still supplying bases of storage and equipment. We are telling you that Saddam is gone, and it is not regrettable, because he was a tyrant and an enemy to God and his prophet Muhammad. He was an enemy. He was gone at the hands of his American masters. But we ask God that you will be eliminated by our hands and swords, and we hope this will be soon." Well, that's a radical end. Iraq cannot survive under a federal system. Eventually we will see Iraq partitioned into two or three states, says regional analyst Labib Kwam Hawal. We'll see what more he has to say, but now we'll say a lot of... That was the radical end of the insurgency in Iraq. And who are we to criticize them? Because what would we do if a foreign country came in and killed millions of our women and children and older people and destroyed thousands of years old temples and cities? And we might even talk about in a little while we will talk about who believes what happened in the recent bombing of the Golden Mosque in Samarra. Let's see. Petitioning would... we'll go on a little bit to seeing what Joost Hilterman, the Middle Eastern Project Director for the International Crisis Group, says. "A lot of Sunni Arab politicians have been working hard towards a government of national unity, but there are a number of spoilers in the Sunni community, and I'm sure he thinks Abu Musab, which I just read out, is one of them. However," says Kwambal, who is a regional analyst, "I think Iraq cannot survive under a federal system. As I just said, eventually we will see Iraq partitioned into two or three states. Petitioning would confine the Shias to their homelands in the south and the Kurds to the northern north. Neither group would have cause to complain because they would be sitting atop the vast subterranean oil reserves at either end of the country that are now the source of so much of the sectarian angst. District MP Mahmoud Abada laid the blame for the mosque bombings at the feet of those with most to lose. I do not think that the bombing is either an attempt by the Sunnis or the Shiites. It is from other infiltrators who want to make sectarian strife. Those who had bombed Ali Hadid Mosque and those who bombed Sunni mosques are agents for Mossad, he says, in the first place, and for the Americans in the second place. The US is the largest beneficiary from the current situation. A civil war delights the Americans. They would be happy viewers. So people within Iraq, an increasing number, because there I saw recent protests where the Sunnis and the Shiites had united in protests against the Americans. And of course Mossad is Israel. It's very difficult to get to the bottom, and only in history itself we will see who really caused all this strife. Regional analyst, a Jordanian regional analyst, Labib Kwamhal, who I've quoted already, says, I would say that the threat of civil war is very, very imminent now. Unless the religious leaders and the political leaders on all sides join force in preventing this possibility, we might see ourselves in the middle of a vicious civil war in a country that lacks effective central control. So what are we going to do about the Middle East? Well, I think one thing we could do is pray, and in this country we could definitely protest very strongly against our involvement in it, because it is a crime in itself. And we could also definitely harass our local politicians. That includes Mr. Ian Cawsley, I believe, who voted for the stopping of the abortion pill coming in, so we know that he's not into women's rights in this country as well, and he's probably a great backer of our involvement and greed in obtaining Middle Eastern oil, when in fact there is many, many things we should be looking at to completely forget about using oil as a power source, and also, of course, uranium, which is a major problem in this country that I've campaigned very heavily against. But right now, I think it's time for... And if you want to hear some more good free media, Friday's radio show with Bob Tissot is an amazing, amusing journey through the frightening specter of political commentary without fear, happily and with absolute confidence. So I'd like to say one more thing before I finish up my show, and that's concerning bottled water. Yes, bottled water is involved in the oil scam as well. Bottled water consumption, which has more than doubled globally in the past 6 years, is heavily taxing the world's ecosystem, a new survey found. While bottled water was often no healthier than tap water in the industrial world, it could end up costing 10,000 times more. That's a lot times more. 10,000 times more than tap water. At as much as $2.50 per litre, bottled water costs more than petrol. US was the largest consumer of bottled water, the American drinking 26 billion litres in 2004, and Australia is very hot on the tail with bottled water everywhere. This has translated into a massive cost in packaging the water, usually in plastic bottles made of polyurethane PET bottles, which is derived from crude oil and then transported in it. Yes, we need to transport all that water around the country using crude oil as well, made into petrol. 86% of plastic water bottles in worldwide end up as rubbish, and about 40% of the PET bottles deposited for recycling in 2004 ended up being shipped to China. So where are we at? Give up buying bottled water, get out there and drink the tap water, which is not much worse, or get a rain tank and save everybody a lot of hassle.